this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
You absolutely need to declare this area as a national disaster area. That has to happen. There are too many people in this community that need health care.
A year after the Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, thousands of residents in the area are suffering illnesses. They are now calling on President Biden to declare it a mass casualty incident site, allowing all residents and all workers involved to get health care.
This is a gene transfection product that billions of people have received, and genetic products need to be monitored for a long period of time. We have countless people injured that are being ignored, and we can't do this anymore.
I'm making the call today. The COVID-19 vaccines should be removed from the market. They're not safe for human use.
When we see these patients, regardless of how they've been injured, we need to bring the loving and compassionate care to bear on these people who have been injured, and we have to find a way to treat them.
Doctors testify about health consequences of the mRNA COVID vaccines at a congressional hearing held on January 12th.
Out of the blue, the AFL-CIO declared that Gacha Buthelezi was to be awarded the George Meany Human Rights Award for fighting for trade unions. Even the right-wing trade unions couldn't believe it.
South African union organizer and labor researcher David Hempson discusses Zionism, labor imperialism, and South Africa. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. One year ago, a Norfolk Southern freight train derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, a town of fewer than 5,000 people on the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. The train was carrying vinyl chloride and other industrial chemicals used to make plastics, paint, solvents, and other products. Some rail cars caught fire and burned for more than 2 days, and emergency crews then conducted a controlled explosion and burn of several more cars, releasing hazardous chemicals into the air and water. The Environmental Protection Agency allowed Norfolk Southern to ignite the chemical cargo and take charge of the cleanup. Thousands of East Palestine residents and emergency responders are now suffering illnesses. Chris Albright, a pipeline worker with Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, 1058, lived within half a mile of the explosion. As a result of the contamination, he now has serious heart problems and requires medication, costing thousands of dollars every month. Since he was too ill to work, he lost his health insurance in January. Now, he's fighting for health care to save his life and is calling on President Biden to invoke the Stafford Act and declare East Palestine a mass casualty incident site, allowing all residents and all workers involved to get health care. Here's Chris Albright speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Life has been hell since the derailment that happened on February 3rd. I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, which actually transitioned into severe heart failure. My heart grew to almost double the size and was hardly pumping any blood. I really thought that I was not going to be around too much longer. Prior to the derailment, I was a very healthy, active man. I was a gas line pipeline worker. My job was very physical, but I loved it. It was great. I enjoyed it. My family was healthy. Everything was going good up until that point. Since the derailment, like I just said, I have congestive heart failure, which turned into severe heart failure. My wife has developed high blood pressure. My one daughter keeps getting nosebleeds every time she would walk in the house. My youngest daughter was getting rashes. You know, all this stuff has been going on. Since the derailment, and because of my heart failure, I have been unable to work since April 13th of last year. I have had no income. I was fortunate enough to have health benefits up until December 31st. I'm taking a myriad of prescription medications now for my heart. But because I wasn't able to work, as of December 31st, 2023, I have no health care. My one prescription alone is $2,700 for a 3 month supply. I can't afford it. That's just one out of many that I have to take. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how things are going to work out for us right now. Luckily my wife does work, but she doesn't make enough to live a comfortable life. We're scratching and clawing to get by on paying bills, on feeding our family and doing things like that. But I don't know how we're going to be able to afford my medications and keep living.
And Norfolk Southern, have they offered to pay for your medical expenses?
They have not. I have had no contact whatsoever with Norfolk Southern. We did relocate for a little while. We stayed in a hotel for 4 months, especially when I was really, really sick. They did pay for that. But the ongoing stuff and the things we've had to deal with since then, we have seen nothing, nothing at all.
And the EPA, government agency, Environmental Protection Agency, is supposed to be in charge of health and safety for workers and residents, communities in this country. What's been their response in East Palestine?
You could probably guess better than what I could. We have had pretty much very little response from the EPA. I have said a couple different times, I was in a major newspaper back in August. The day after that article came out, I had a phone call, which I didn't recognize the number, so I let it go to voicemail. And after I listened to the voicemail, it was the EPA who called me up. The day after that, they were at my door. It took a article in a nationwide newspaper for them to actually come to our door to see how I was doing. I had nothing prior to that whatsoever.
And there must be a lot of stress of other residents in the community. You live, I understand, a half a mile from where this incident took place. You weren't informed. Your family was not informed about the danger of these dioxides that were being ignited. So there are probably many other residents in your situation who have serious health problems. Is that your concern?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I was to walk out my front door and walk down the street, there is a number of vacant houses, people have moved away. People are still here who are still being affected by this, but don't have any means to do anything about it. We can't just pick up and move. You know, a lot of people, I have a family member who lives in Texas, and his first thought, you know, that he told me was get out of there, move. I can't, especially now that I'm not working. I don't have income right now. Nobody's going to give me a loan. Nobody's going to do anything to help me out with that. How am I supposed to do that? You know, my wife has been in this house for 20 years now, 19, 20 years. We can't just pick up at a moment's notice and move. And I know that there are other families in town. I know of plenty of them that are experiencing the same thing.
And has Norfolk Southern offered to buy your house and allow you to move so that you can get income from your house?
Nope, not at all.
They should?
I definitely think there should be something going on. They really need to do something to help us out. Again, they did let us live in a hotel, which living in a hotel when you have four people and two dogs is not the best thing that you can think would happen. It was not a good time for us.
And President Biden announced that he will be coming to East Palestine. It's taken him a long time. Were you surprised that he didn't show up? I know that former President Trump showed up at East Palestine. He is going to be coming in February. What would you like to say to President Biden?
Oh, there's a lot I'd like to say to him, a whole lot. Number one, what took you so long? Why did you wait a year to come and see us? That is number one. Why did you wait so long? Number two, you absolutely need to declare this area as a national disaster area. That has to happen. There are too many people in this community that need health care, and you have the power to do it. And to wait a year before you come out here, you visited other places. You actually flew over top of us going somewhere else one time and couldn't stop here at East Palestine to look after your citizens. You are the president. These are your citizens. And the fact that you had to wait a year to come here infuriates me. And the fact that nothing you have done has helped us to get health care, to do anything for us, infuriates me. We need health care. We need this area to be declared a national disaster area. You have the power to do that. You need to do that.
And there's a campaign that's being launched on Saturday, the anniversary, to get unions, community groups, labor around the country to make this demand on President Biden. You think there should be a national effort to force that he do that? I mean, he can't.
Absolutely.
The Stafford Act.
Absolutely. This, here's the one thing about what happened here in East Palestine, and I hope everybody understands this. This can happen in your community. For all the people who think that this was a one-off, that this could, you know, this only happened in a small little town of East Palestine. It can happen anywhere. The railroads still have not put in place any regulations to stop this kind of tragedy from happening. It can happen anywhere. For all those people, you know, who think it's not going to happen in their town, we never thought it would happen in our town. It can happen anywhere, at any time. So, yes, this needs to be a national concern. It absolutely does.
And there have been reports about the fact that there continue to be railroad derailments, wrecks of the railroads. It seems that the serious issues raised by the catastrophe in East Palestine are being ignored by the government, by the politicians, and these railroads are still operating business as usual. Do you get that feeling?
Absolutely. Again, the railroad workers actually wanted to strike at one point in time, not all that long ago, over safety concerns and everything. And our government told them they could not strike. The railroads have the power. Now, me and everybody I know, we all know we need the railroads. We have to have the railroads. They transport so many things throughout our country. But there needs to be safety measures put in place that are not there. You got to start putting people over profit. You cannot decimate a community like ours and get away with it. It's not right. It's not the moral, it's not the ethical thing to do.
That was East Palestine Liuna 1058 pipeline worker Chris Albright speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Journalist Maximilian Alvarez is the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network. He has covered the struggle of East Palestine residents and workers to protect their healthcare, community, and jobs. He spoke at a panel on the one-year anniversary of the February 3, 2023 disaster.
And I came to the story of East Palestine a year after spending, you know, like just all my time interviewing railroad workers, right? The vast majority of whom, in fact, all of whom, were warning in some way or another that something like East Palestine was inevitable if we did not substantively address the issues that workers across the 12, 13 different unions and the representing, you know, over 100,000 workers on the freight rail system were screaming about, you know, during the high stakes contract fight that was mentioned earlier. And lo and behold, after both parties in Congress, including, you know, Joe Biden, like Bush did in the 90s, you know, anyone who's in power is going to do the exact same thing. They're going to invoke the Railway Labor Act. They're going to force contracts down workers' throats. They're going to side with the industry and effectively give the industry the thumbs up to keep doing what it has been doing. And what it has been doing is destroying our supply chain by destroying the people who run it, right? And so, I was talking to those people from my show all throughout the year last year. And some in really harrowing pointed detail were warning that the longer these trains got, the fewer people we had on those trains, the fewer people we had checking the track, the fewer people we had checking the cars, the more we were automating different essential like functions, maintenance, safety, dispatchers in the dispatch office, the more that we were essentially cutting corners, cutting costs so that they could, you know, make record profits, juice the bottom lines of executives and shareholders, right? Something was going to give. And we, our people, our neighbors, people like Chris and his neighbors, we are the ones who are paying for that corporate greed. And I want to impress upon everyone here, anyone who's going to listen to this afterwards, kind of two things that I try to impress upon people whenever I'm asked to talk about this. The first is that the catastrophic derailment of the Norfolk Southern train this time last year and the subsequent decision to, quote, do a controlled burn of 5 cars worth of toxic vinyl chloride, even when that was not the recommended action by the people who make the vinyl chloride. That whole mess is one of the greatest industrial accidents in our country's history. And a catastrophe of equal or greater proportion could literally happen again tomorrow, because we have done nothing to substantively address the conditions that led to the catastrophic derailment in East Palestine, to the lack of regulation and enforcement from the government side that is given not just Norfolk Southern, but all the class one freight rail carriers the license to do whatever the hell they want with our supply chain. Again, the contract fight showed the government's not going to incentivize these companies to act differently. So we got to be the ones to force their hand. So that's the first thing. This could happen again tomorrow. We haven't done pardon my French, to really address the root causes. The Railway Labor Act has gone nowhere, even though a number of politicians have made political hay out of it. And then when it recedes from the news, once again, it gets dropped. Meanwhile, families like the Albrights are boiling in this hell that they have been left with, that they did not ask for, that they had nothing to do with, and the country has forgotten about them. This is supposed to be the greatest country on earth, and this is what we do to our people. This is what we do to our neighbors. We abandon them. We just draw a circle around them and say, this is a sacrifice zone now. You could stay here and die and get cancer and watch your town slowly die. Or if you have enough money, you can move, but we're not going to do anything to help you. This is happening not just in East Palestine. This is happening across the country. This is happening in Flint. This is happening in Navajo Nation, where uranium mining has been giving people cancers for decades. This is happening in Red Hill in Hawaii, where people can't drink the water because the army has been poisoning it, right? This is happening here in Baltimore near a CSX terminal that has also been declared a sacrifice zone because it's getting coal dust everywhere. There are not going to be any zones left to sacrifice if we keep going down this road and not standing and fighting against the relentless onslaught of corporate greed and the destruction of all that we hold dear. Because that's what I really want to emphasize coming back to this, is that for families like the Albrights, and they're not alone, as we've already mentioned. I've been interviewing residents and families in this community, not just in East Palestine, but also want to mention how important it is for folks in the surrounding area, people in Pennsylvania. It's not like that the gas from all of that vinyl chloride just decided to stop at the Pennsylvania border, right? I mean, that has been poisoning people's land, air, water. People are feeling health effects for miles beyond the crash site. But for Norfolk Southern, if you don't live within a 1 mile radius of that crash site, you're basically on your own. And even a lot of people in that have been on their own. That we did not address the issues on the railroads that workers themselves have been warning was going to lead to a catastrophe for years to anyone who would listen. That we did not address those years ago is a national tragedy. That the community of East Palestine has been so thoroughly abandoned by Norfolk Southern, by the government, by the media, and by our country is a national disgrace, an absolute national disgrace. We should, yes, be empathetic. We should care for these people, but we should be mad. We should be angry that this is happening in our country. We should be angry that we are going around telling people that we have the right to tell other countries how to run their societies when this is what we are doing to our own, right? I mean, we need to stop this. We need to actually band together and fight back. Otherwise, they're going to take everything from us and leave us in just as much of a hopeless situation as the folks of East Palestine have been left in. So I'm here to help however I can. I'm trying the best I can on the media side. But we're an independent nonprofit outlet. Only so many people listen to us. And I really, really want to emphasize how incredible it is that out of all the national media, a strike newspaper run by striking journalists for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who have been on strike unpaid for a year and a half, have done more coverage on this than most national media. That is insane.
That was radio host and executive producer of the Real News Network, Maximilian Alvarez, on the one-year anniversary of the train wreck and toxic catastrophe in East Palestine, Ohio. He was speaking on a community panel.
In 1985, Don DeLillo wrote a book called White Noise, relating self-worth to the value of the things that we buy in order to forget our ending. But all you really need to know for this song is that in that book, a train derails and explodes like a bomb releasing toxic gas, and that used to be fiction. It ain't us, said the CEO of Norfolk Southern. Ain't us either, said the government. Must have been God or luck, that ain't so good. It ain't us, said the people of East Ohio. No one to blame, all the while East Palestine's a poison neighborhood. In 2014, Congress passed a bill that required trains that could toxic spill to have electric pneumatic brakes that were all real shiny. Those old air brakes too fine with freight, but with toxic material, you can't make mistakes. $6 million in donations, that bill was gone. It ain't us, said the CEO of Norfolk Southern. Ain't us either, said the government. Must have been God or luck, that ain't so good. It ain't us, said the people of East Ohio. No one to blame, all the while East Palestine's a poison neighborhood.
That was Connor Ryan Hennessy singing East Palestine, Ohio. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, Pacifica reporter Thomas O'Rourke has a follow-up on COVID-19 vaccine injuries. This supplements an earlier interview of Dr. Peter McCullough from the January 22, 2024 episode of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
A second congressional hearing on COVID-19 vaccine injuries was held January 12th of this year, following an initial hearing held November 13th, 2023. You'll hear Drs. Ryan Cole, Peter McCulloch, and Kirk Milhone testify about aspects of the health consequences of the mRNA genetic therapies, or vaccine, at a congressional hearing chaired by Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I'm Dr. Ryan Cole. I'm a board-certified anatomic and clinical pathologist trained at the Mayo Clinic. I've been in practice for over 20 years and ran an independent medical laboratory for two decades and ended up having to sell that because I spoke out against this COVID narrative and got canceled by insurance companies for, quote, unprofessional behavior for telling the truth. You know, we're at an unprecedented time in American history. And it used to be that we were a nation of the people, for the people, by the people. And now we're of the corporation, for the corporation, and by the corporation. Countless Americans have been harmed because people have believed biased media. People have believed corrupt pharmaceutical narratives. Countless people in this nation are hurting and being ignored. Now, I'm a pathologist. The pathologist is the most important doctor that you never meet, that you always hope is right. So we see a part of people every day. We see your blood. We see your microbiology. We see your tissues under the microscope. And the cells don't lie. And what we've found in this unfortunate 4 years is we've been ignored. We see the damage, but we see what's happening to the people. And I'm tired of the American people being gaslit and being told, well, it's anything and everything, but it's not the, quote, vaccine. This is a gene transfection product that billions of people have received. And genetic products need to be monitored for a long period of time. We have countless people injured that are being ignored. And we can't do this anymore. And, you know, I'm not here to judge people. If you got one shot, two shot, three shots, whatever, I'm not here to judge. I'm just saying don't get another one. This is an unproven, unsafe product. We need to acknowledge that there's injury happening around the world. And we need to stop these products immediately, not just the COVID shots. Any mRNA platform going forward is unproven and unsafe. And this is about an oath that all of us took. We took an oath to first do no harm, primum non nocere. We take that oath seriously. Most of us sitting here have given up almost everything. So we're grateful to be here, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to ask questions or answer any questions you may ask going forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cole. Dr. Peter McCullough.
Madam Chairwoman and Senator Johnson, Mr. Davidson, it's a great honor to be here as I've been in Washington now several times. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I'm trained in public health and have a master's degree in public health and epidemiology. I'm very experienced in academic medicine. I have over 780 peer-reviewed publications cited in the National Library of Medicine. I have over 70 papers on the COVID-19 pandemic, both on many aspects of the pandemic, including early treatment, and now vaccine injuries, disabilities, and deaths. I have been on data safety monitoring boards and interacted with the FDA and big pharma and device companies. I've interacted with the European medicine agencies as well as the MHRA in the past, lectured at virtually every medical school in the United States. I'm well known to all of them. You know, we're 4 years into this, and this is the first time that the U.S. House of Representatives has heard from doctors who are directly treating patients with both COVID-19 and the vaccine injuries. That's 4 years too late. I think that's a very important lesson learned. I never supported these vaccines. I never told a single patient that it was safe to take a vaccine. I didn't take a COVID-19 vaccine myself because it wasn't safe. And I published an op-ed in The Hill in August of 2020, before they came out. The title of that op-ed is The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Pandemic. The reason why it was a gamble is because the vaccines, and of Americans who took the vaccine, it's roughly 75% of Americans took at least one shot, according to the COVID States program. Of those, 94% took a messenger RNA vaccine. So we can restrict our comments to messenger RNA vaccines provided by Pfizer and Moderna. These vaccines are a brand new technology that installs the genetic code for the lethal part of the virus, which is the spike protein, the spine on the surface of the virus. This was an extraordinary gamble because there was no knowledge of what was going to turn this off. Once the genetic code gets in the body, there was no knowledge of, does the body get rid of the genetic code? What shuts it off? Will some people produce too much genetic code and have it keep moving from cell to cell and too much spike protein? It was known then that the spike protein was lethal. And to give a genetic code for a potentially lethal protein to Americans was the most dangerous proposition our government agencies could have ever put forward to our country. And what we've learned on this is extraordinary. Castriuta and colleagues has published the messenger RNA is physically circulating in the blood for at least 28 days. That's as long as they've looked. Crossan and colleagues from Harvard has shown the messenger RNA is stuck in the human heart 30 days after the vaccine when people die. And there's inflammation around it, presumably due to the spike protein. Wolkin and colleagues from Stanford have shown the messenger RNA is stuck in human lymph nodes for at least 2 months. And that's as long as they've looked. Now, the spike protein, which is produced by the messenger RNA, is widely circulatory in blood and shown by Harvard, by Ogata and colleagues, Swank, and recently Brogna in Germany. Now, Brogna in Germany looked 6 months afterwards, and at least half the people who took the shots had vaccine spike protein circulating in their bloodstream. That's as long as they've looked. And they can identify it because Pfizer and Moderna have an amino acid signature on their spike protein to let us identify. We know that it's Pfizer and Moderna. It doesn't come from the natural virus. It's coming from the vaccine. That's proven. The spike protein now, in 3,400 peer-reviewed papers and growing, is proven to cause heart damage and myocarditis. Our regulatory agencies agree. Every regulatory agency in the world agrees. There's actually guidelines now in the UK and Australia about how to diagnose and manage vaccine myocarditis. That's how common this is. It accelerates atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, causes tremendous swings in blood pressure and heart rate called posterior orthostatic tachycardia syndrome or POTS, causes neurologic injury, stroke, both ischemic and hemorrhagic, paralyzing syndromes, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, small fiber neuropathy, ear ringing. It causes blood clots. The spike protein is physically found in blood clots. The largest blood clots that we've ever seen in clinical medicine, typically a blood clot that someone would get after a hip surgery or on an airplane would be a centimeter or so. It's common in my practice. Yesterday, I saw patients with 15, 17, 2 feet blood clots in their legs after the vaccine. We see blood clots both on the arterial side and on the venous side. This is distinctly unusual. The body is set up after the vaccine to form blood clots. And this is particularly harmful in people with a predilection to blood clots or other provocateurs, hip surgery, smoking, supplemental estrogens, prolonged immobility, et cetera. The fourth major category where the vaccines clearly cause injury and damage is autoimmunity. The human body recognizes the spike protein as non-human. And so the body attacks its own cells in an attempt to try to fight this. And because of this,
the body then expresses markers of autoimmunity that now I routinely test in my practice, the anti-nuclear antibody, the ANA test, which is a test we do for systemic lupus, the anti-citrullinated peptide test for rheumatoid arthritis, and then the ANCA test, the anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody test. These are now all proven in the peer-reviewed literature. These blood tests turn positive in response to the vaccine, and people develop a variety of autoimmune syndromes. This is what we're seeing clinically. So my observations are based in terms of what I'm seeing clinically, what I'm reading in the peer-reviewed literature. And in the peer-reviewed literature, large numbers of cases are being reported. I want to cite one paper from the peer-reviewed literature, Lane and colleagues, that's assembled now a series of 18,204 patients with myopericarditis. 18,000. Now, I can tell you, my whole career, I saw two cases before COVID-19. Now I am seeing myocarditis on a daily basis. The number of myocarditis cases in the United States before the pandemic was roughly 200 to 400 cases in the whole country per year. Now we're seeing this in the thousands, and these are limited sets. Now, of those 18,204 spontaneously reported cases, the death rate in these patients is 0.22. So fortunately, majority of people survive, but sadly, some die. In the published papers of people describing the cases, the death rate has ranged from 0.41 for myopericarditis to 45.9%. 45.9%. Holscher and colleagues, of which I am a senior author on this paper, is now has a paper in the preprint server. Now it's been fully accepted to the European Society of Cardiology Journal, has proven that myocarditis is fatal when autopsies are confirmed. When the doctors suspect myocarditis, there's a 100% rate of confirmation that it's fatal myocarditis. When there's general death that's occurred in a vaccinated patient, our data suggest that it's roughly 74%. If an autopsy would be done, it would be confirmed that the vaccine was the cause of death. Today, a Rasmussen poll is out, and the Rasmussen poll has shown that 53% of Americans think the COVID-19 vaccines are causing serious injuries leading to large numbers of, quote, unexplained deaths. So the word is out. I've made the call on the floor of the with Senator Johnson and a panel in the U.S. Senate, multiple state senates, the European Parliament. I'm making the call today. The COVID-19 vaccines should be removed from the market. They're not safe for human use. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McAuliffe. Thank you very much. Dr. Milhone.
Yes, thank you very much. What an honor it is to be here. My name is Kirk Milhone. I am board certified in pediatrics and pediatric cardiology. Before my medical degree, I got a PhD in cardiovascular physiology and pharmacology. My thesis was on what causes inflammation in the heart. Just so happens the pathway I was studying is the exact pathway that COVID, the spike protein, causes inflammation within our body. I wanted to share what my heart is that I bring to this hearing as a physician and a scientist. And it goes back to two basic historic ancient texts. Dr. Ryan Cole already alluded to the Hippocratic Oath, which says, do no harm. So as physicians, we are called. We have taken an oath to do no harm. The second, and I consider this as I share my thoughts and my education and my experiences, comes from the Bible. And it says, the goal of my instruction is love, from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. When I share what I'm seeing in my patients and throughout the literature, I share from a place of compassion, not of judgment. When we see these patients, regardless of how they've been injured, we need to bring the loving and compassionate care to bear on these people who have been injured, and we have to find a way to treat them. We can't just let them. There are too many of them, as Dr. McCullough so clearly put out. And I wanted, as he said at the end, at what Rasmussen was seeing, I wanted to share, because sometimes it's interesting to when we're facing sometimes the non-science, when we're facing something, the non-scientists often show us and they look at data a little bit differently. And a lot of times that comes from the insurance company, because the insurance company is basing their entire livelihood on well people not getting sick and knowing what percentage of well people should get sick. So Ed Dowd is one of those financial guys, and he's been looking at the insurance data.
And his research team recently evaluated the data out of UK. And it was from the United Kingdom death and disability trends for cardiovascular diseases in 15 to 44 year olds. What's important about that statement is you shouldn't have cardiovascular disease in 15 to 44 year olds. So if this is now a spike, this is something we really have to look at. So they found very concerning data, and I quote, "We show a large increase in the morbidity and mortality due to disease of the cardiovascular system from 2021. The increase in disability claims is consistent with the increase in excess deaths, and both are highly significant. The data show a 13% increase in excess cardiovascular death in 2020, then a 30% increase in 2021, and a 44% increase in 2022. Something significantly has increased excess cardiovascular deaths in 2021, and it continues. As humans, physicians, and scientists, we should be curious with what has happened. There's really only one major thing that happened in 2021, and that was the rollout of this untested vaccine. So as we go forward, I'll be happy to answer questions and go into deeper explanations of and try to bring truth and transparency and honesty to this discussion. But thank you for making this happen.
Thank you. Powerful opening testimonies. Thank you each. I'd like to start out, one of the things that's talked about is vaccine hesitancy. So I just want to ask you guys in the beginning, what is the difference? Dr. McCullough, I'll start with you. What is the difference between the old vaccines we've grown up with that we know and trust versus the mRNA vaccine that's now the COVID vaccine but could be made into more vaccines? Could you explain that a little bit?
The existing vaccines, now they have grown in number and intensity over time, and the mothers know this on the childhood schedule. It's called the ACIP schedule. ACIP mm-hmm. is a committee charged by the CDC to recommend what American children should receive. These conventional vaccines are either proteins, such as the tetanus toxoid or the pneumococcal protein, hepatitis B protein. And they're simply proteins that the body responds to. The proteins themselves can't cause disease. You can't get tetanus from a tetanus shot. Or they are killed viruses. So, for instance, influenza is a killed virus. You get a flu shot. You can't get flu from a flu shot because the virus is killed. But people get flu-like syndrome, and they get confused with this. But it's a killed virus. Or it's a live attenuated virus. That is, the virus is alive, but it's crippled and it can't cause serious disease. And an example there would be the shingles vaccine or the chickenpox vaccine. And people will know that because if they've ever had the shingles vaccine, of which I've had, one will have a very serious reaction in the arm because the virus is alive. It just can't cause full-blown shingles, but it can cause a serious reaction. All of these conventional vaccines limit the degree of which the vaccine itself can directly cause disease. Now, there are vaccine reactions, and there can be serious immune reactions to vaccines that are recognized. Mm-hmm. And they're so serious that in 1986, under the Reagan administration, the Congress and HHS wrote the vaccine injury compensation legislation, mm-hmm. which said conventional vaccines have unavoidable harms. So even the conventional vaccines that we trust, I've taken them all, my children have taken them all, they do have unavoidable harms. And what's grown out of this is people have felt that if something has a harm, there must be freedom of choice on all forms of vaccines at every level. So no vaccine should be mandated, in my view, at any level. Mm-hmm. None of them are sufficiently compelling. None of them completely prevent the disease. The conventional vaccines actually have little data to support they block transmission. Our CDC on the website says the polio vaccine doesn't stop transmission. They said right on their website. So we don't have all the major outbreaks of pertussis and diphtheria. They all occur mumps. They all occur when people are vaccinated. So these vaccines are not perfect, but they do provide a basis of which we try to ensure some health of our pediatric population. Messenger RNA is drastically different. Mm-hmm. Messenger RNA is the genetic code for part of a virus. And when it installs in the human body, it hijacks the body's machinery to read the genetic called ribosomes, and then they produce an uncontrolled amount of a protein, in this case, the spike protein, for an uncontrolled duration of time. So this is very different than a tetanus shot. Tetanus shot is a specific amount of tetanus toxoid, period. The body digests and goes away. This is genetic code that produces the spike protein, it looks like, potentially indefinitely. The human body, to our knowledge, has no way of breaking down the messenger RNA and has no way of breaking down the spike protein. There are no described enzymatic pathways for the human body to dispose of this. In my view, the COVID-19 vaccine program has complicated this because people have taken unprecedented numbers of shots. If one was to follow the U.S. government program right now, taking a shot every 6 months with the primary series, they'd be approaching 10 shots. This is unprecedented to give 10 sets of inoculations.
That was Drs. Ryan Cole, Peter McCulloch, and Kirk Milhone testifying about health consequences of the mRNA COVID vaccines at a congressional hearing held January 12th of this year. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy at Pacifica Radio, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
Oye, me dio una fiebre el otro día por causa de tu amor, Cristiana. Que fui a parar enfermería sin yo tener seguro de cama. Y me inyectaron suero de colores, hey, y me sacaron la radiografía y me diagnosticaron mal de amores, al ver mi corazón como latía. Uy, y me trastearon hasta el alma con rayo X cirugía. Y es que la ciencia no funciona, solo tu beso, vida mía. Ay, negra, mira, búscate un catete, ey, inyéctame tu amor como insulina y dame vitamina de cariño, ey, que me ha subido la bilirrubina. Me sube la bilirrubina,
ay, me sube la bilirrubina.
Cuando te miro y no me miras,
ay, cuando te miro y no me miras.
Y no lo quita la pirina.
That was Juan Luis Guerra, La Bilirrubina. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. The International Labor Education Project on the AFL-CIO recently held a panel on the AFL-CIO, Zionism, Imperialism, and South Africa. Durban trade union organizer and labor researcher David Hemson talked about the Histadrut, Israel's national trade union center, which represents the majority of Israel's trade unionists.
What we have seen is that the Histadrut, as I mentioned, is not just it has some pretensions as a trade union, but it is also the biggest employer in Israel. This was astonishing to me to understand. But if you understand all the work that it's done in terms of concentrating capital and doing banking, housing, education, and in the beginning, it seemed to serve as a kind of nucleus of the Israeli state itself with the militia all of that. And because of that, intervention in South Africa has not really been on the trade union field until the 1980s, but it was very much involved in the development of the armaments industry in South Africa. So how could a trade union be involved in the armaments industry? It's unbelievable. But because they had companies in Israel, which were breaking free from French, they had a deal with the French armaments industry, and that broke down in the 1970s, France refused to continue it. That meant that Israel, and the Histadrut was involved in this, was involved in helping South Africa, which was also suffering from arms ban, to develop its own arms industry. And I had to serve in the South African military for a period. Don't worry, I was in active opposition and shut them up when they tried to come with the idea that we were dealing with terrorists. Because I said, well, look, I'm a terrorist too. I'm a communist, by the way. And they were so shocked. I said, well, you can expel me. I wouldn't mind not doing the military service. But in the end, the guys would say, hey, what's really happening here? Are we really going to win this? I said, guys, you're going to lose. But don't cry, because I'm telling you right now, it's not going to work out the way. Anyway, look, let me not ramble on about that. But I was based in the north of, just south of Mozambique. And there was a rocket area, an area for trying out rockets. And that was known then, and that was in the 1970s, to be a joint Israeli-South African project. So, you know, it's hard to disentangle a history from all of this because it was involved. It's an intimate part of the Israeli state. And there it was trying out, you know, all their rockets in a beautiful area of which should have been protected against any military operations, you know, at all. And then just to mention another fact, that then led to the nuclear power being developed and the bomb being developed in Israel. That arose out of collaboration with South Africa, because South Africa provided the uranium for that bomb to be prepared and made. And obviously the transaction went both ways, so that you know, all the advanced technology that was needed to make the bomb was available to South Africa. I was in Dar es Salaam in exile at a university there in 1979. And we heard on the 27th of September, 1979, that there was an explosion somewhere down towards the Antarctic, Marion Island. And we knew what had happened. I mean, there was fear in Dar es Salaam and the university and elsewhere, because we knew that South Africa had the bomb. But it wasn't South Africa's bomb. It was actually an Israeli trying out their bomb together with the South Africans and teaching them, how to build. So it's hard to disentangle the history from the from the state. But there is an integration at the trade union level in this way. In the 1970s, we developed independent trade union movement. It was we struggled with very little support internationally, but we, you know, it was a bootstrap operation with bannings. I mean, none of us lasted for more than 9 months or a year or so forth before we were declared communists and house arrested and then banned from all kind of future kinds of work. So it was a massive struggle, which wasn't supported by the AFL CIO or the TUC at all, because it was independent. We were struggling to be independent from the traditional dominators of our country, and to build a base for a freedom movement, which wouldn't be another nationalist movement, which would lead the workers into disaster, but would lead on towards genuine trade unions and the vision of socialism, which we talked about in the Workers' Party and so forth. I won't go into all that. But the AFL-CIO, when it saw that the unions were developing rapidly, it did its best to try and divide try and break up the union. I'm sure that all the people participating here knew that South Africa had Bantustans. And one of the Bantustans, the one particularly in Natal, in the area on the eastern seacoast, was the Zulu Bantustan, headed by Chief Gacha Buthelezi, who has no pretensions to be the actual traditional leader. It was all, I won't go into all the tricks that he played to get into power. He got his brother deported out of the area by the state. I mean, he came to power by hook or by crook. But, you know, out of the blue, without having done anything to support the labor movement, in fact, through undermining and killing students who opposed him and breaking up strikes and the rest, out of the blue, the AFL-CIO declared that Gacha Buthelezi was to be awarded the George Meany Human Rights Award for fighting for trade unions. Even the right-wing trade unions couldn't believe it. He'd done absolutely nothing, but he had attended Washington. He was, the quote-unquote peaceful leader that the CIA was looking for. And so they just threw out that award. Oddly enough, there's not even a picture of him accepting the award. It was an absolute, as I said, the leadership was kind of disastrous. It did impulsive things. Not even the people that wanted the AFL-CIO to be involved in South Africa could understand what on earth happened. It was a disaster, but it showed where they wanted it to go. I was I met up with the IFCFTU in 1976 when I was banned and ended up in exile. And I was shown a secret document. I was told I had to see it and I wasn't allowed to copy it and so forth. And that was a letter from the AFL-CIO to the ICFTU. And remember, they didn't participate in the ICFTU. They wanted to manipulate it from outside. And that said that they were going to give AFL-CIO was going to give Gacha Buthelezi $1 million. That was a huge sum at that time to organize trade unions. I think if we managed to get something like $5,000 a year to organize ourselves with the bootstrap operation that we had, we would have said that was great. Imagine $1 million being put in the hands of one of those who was turning out to be one of the great persecutors and killers of the emerging trade union movement in South Africa. And what did happen, I won't go into all the details because of time, but then as the workers' insurgency developed in the 1980s, from the early 1980s onwards until 1985 was general strike after general strike, making South Africa ungovernable by the nationalist party, the racist regime of the time. The AFL suddenly became very involved. Gacha Buthelezi suddenly remembered that he was the hero of the AFL-CIO. So he launched a trade union, UWSA, UWUSA, United Workers Union of South Africa, which actually was just a killing organization. In fact, it even launched itself as a killing organization with a coffin in leading of a militia. And the slogan was death to COSATU. COSATU was the national movement, the grouping of the trade unions of the time, which was espousing liberation and socialism. And their slogan was death to COSATU. And they carried a coffin to show what they were going to do. And that was supported by the AFL-CIO. And now I've only just discovered that Buthelezi had actually visited Israel in 1985 and that the deal was made with the Histadrut, which had, of course, many parts to it. So it had a trade union side, although they didn't seem to, that didn't really get developed in South Africa. What they did have was a militia, a killing organization, a death squad. And, you know, the regime in from 1986 onwards developed and trained up, killers in Nawusa and in Nkata. And it's no doubt that Histadrut was involved in all of this, as well as providing the arms, the rockets, and all the other apparatus, you know, that the apartheid regime, had. You know, we have Israeli and Zionist investment in South Africa. In fact, 3 years ago in 2021, we had a strike of Clover workers. That's a dairy workers, the biggest dairy company in South Africa, was bought out by an Israeli company. And immediately it cut the wages, it put the workers on short time and all the rest. They wanted to cut the workers at least by a third and to raise their profits and to integrate the production into the Israeli economy, and not based on South African production. A complete scam. But the ANC government, which of course now has got all the credit for having gone to the ICJ, actually defended that resolutely against the criticism that we in exile fought for by the General Workers Union of South Africa, which was waging that strike, talking to the ministers, demanding that they, you know, upend this investment, which was a disinvestment because actually it meant extracting capital from South Africa, and that went ahead. It was a fantastic strike. Unfortunately, it wasn't a complete 100% victory, but it showed the resistance that would be there. But in the end, we found that the government actually defended the regime. I mean, that company to the end. And the workers actually had to stand down, and it was a very bitter pill indeed. Now we support that, going to the ICJ in that sense, but with our eyes wide open. We know that ANC is, unfortunately, it's developed into quite a rotten and corrupt leadership. And electricity is only partially available. The railways have collapsed completely. The ports and harbors are meant to be well run by the state. Instead of that, now they're offering it all for privatization. It's a disaster for the working class. But at least it's struggled now to put forward a bright face of revolution, or at least a solidarity with the Palestinians. And that part, we support.
That was South African union organizer and labor researcher David Hempson. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Anne Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.